From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
I personally prefer to use Afro-Latina, more Afro-Latino, because I really want to recognize the fact that my roots do stem from Africa.
Today, we focus on Afro-Latino identity and experiences. Young Afro-Latinos are eager for better representation in media and elsewhere. And we go to Honduras, where an Afro-Latino community is fighting for its ancestral land, the Garifuna people.
We've been living here for years after years, you know what I'm saying? For centuries. We ain't got no other place to live. Where else we gonna go?
Plus the music of Buica and the insight of Dr. Marta Moreno Vega. All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we talk Afro-Latino identity. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Thanks for listening to Latino USA. But before we start our show, let me take a minute to introduce you to NPR Music's other discovery podcast. It's called Alt Latino. Hosts Felix Contreras and Jasmine Guards are your guides into the world of Latino music. Trust me, it's not a stodgy museum tour. There's alternative approaches to traditional music, interviews with icons like Calle 13 and Carlos Santana. So you can find Alt Latino now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. If you go by pop culture, it's easy to think that the few Latinos you do see have a certain kind of look. Actors like Jennifer Lopez, John Leguizamo, or Eva Longoria have become the Hollywood definition of Latino. But within the Latino family, you're likely to see people of all shapes, sizes, and shades. Some of us have fair skin, straight hair, and light eyes. Others, like me, are mestizas, with brown hair and eyes and olive skin. And still others have dark skin and curly or kinky hair. Many fall somewhere in between all of these. Now, it isn't just Hollywood that's pushing the idea of a certain type of Latino look. The Latino media, from news to entertainment, largely focuses on light-skinned Latinos and, oh, so many blonde Latinos and Latinas. Here on Latino USA, we make a point of including all sorts of Latino voices. We want to tell stories that convey the diversity of the Latino experience. But we're a radio show, and you, mis queridos listeners, can't see our guests. So for today's show, we'll be focusing explicitly on the Afro-Latino experience. And we're going to start by hearing directly from Afro-Latinos in a segment we call Somos, which means we are.
My name is Janelle Martinez, and I am the founder of Ain't I Latina. I grew up in the Bronx, New York, by way of Honduras. You know, Latinos, we're not monolithic, right? You can be Latino. I personally prefer to use Afro-Latina or Afro-Latino because I really want to recognize the fact that my roots do stem from Africa. It's just a matter of celebrating what you are and really being okay with that. Definitely, I didn't see myself reflected in media growing up. I was always really into magazines, and actually that's where I had my major and was in magazine journalism. And so I recall very early on, you know, with subscriptions that my family had, you know, we had Jet, we had Ebony, we had Essence, you know, I think even at one time we had People in Espanol. And I felt like, yeah, I would see someone that looked like me in like Ebony or Jet or Essence. But when I was looking in People in Espanol, like I was like, you know, I mean, this is in our native tongue and I'm not seeing anyone that looks like me. I always had the question in my mind, like, why do I have to go to one or the other? Why can't I see that representation in one location? And I think that that really was the driving force for me to launch my site Ain't I Latina, because I love magazines and I love traditional media, but I felt like the message is going to go further if I have a site. So I get a lot of response, particularly on Ain't I Latina's Everyday Chica feature, where on a weekly basis on the site we highlight an Afro-Latina just doing amazing things, whether she's an entrepreneur or she's in fashion, a designer. I really think it's just so important for women to have a strong sense of self, because coming from all areas, you know, in media, you're being told that you're not beautiful, your life doesn't matter, you know, you should try to achieve Eurocentric features and you should do this and that. And it's like, you are who you are. You were born in the skin that you're in, and rock out with that. Like, that's who you are. And so I know it sounds like hard to accept, and I'm even just now 100% getting comfortable in that skin myself, and I'm 26 years old, you know? So it takes time, but once you've gotten to that place, or not even just in that journey of finding and understanding your value and just being comfortable with who you are, like, it's a beautiful thing, and just embrace it. There is more awareness and more conversations, I find, that we're having, especially in the digital space. And so for me, it is just really important to bring attention to that. And I'm happy to see more celebration of, you know, Latino history and our roots, in particular, Afro-Latinos.
My name is Anthony Otero, and I am from the Bronx, and I am Puerto Rican and Ecuadorian. I believe that a lot of the issues that I had years ago when I first sort of declared myself as an Afro-Latino was that there weren't enough of us out there, but that has changed dramatically since, let's just say, 2003. I mean, Twitter, Tumblr, what remains the same is, no matter how much we put ourselves out there, there's still issues of inequality within our own culture. I mean, it's one thing to sort of deal with prejudice or racism, you know, from white people, but it's just your own culture. It takes, I don't want to say a little getting used to, but I think it takes some time to really understand. I can tell you numerous amounts of times in which I've had discussions about not bringing a black woman home, you know, and I would look at people in my family and I'm like, I mean, I know what I see when I look in the mirror, and I'm darker than you. So for you to say that is sort of a slap in my face. I very much will tell anybody that I'm black. Some people have an issue with this identification. I try very often when I do discuss this to say that everything is sort of black and white. You know, it's the black and white binary, and everything else is sort of like gray. And that extends to pretty much all cultures, particularly within Latin America and the Caribbean. I think a lot of it probably starts around, and I'm not a historian, so, but I think a lot of it probably starts around slavery. You know, a good deal of the slave trade was conducted in Central and South America. And I believe a small portion ended up in North America. So a lot of the thoughts, a lot of the actions and the brutality and all that stuff very much happened within South America, Latin America, the Caribbean. And I think that much of the thought process in terms of skin color remained from there.
The harsh realities of life have taken toll. Even Jesus Christ forsake my soul. Please tell me what price to pay to make it whole. Take control. I'm making dough, but not enough to blow. J.O.'s, they lost my flow, but they yo.
Oh, hi, my name is Sophia Arzu.
My name is Victoria Arzu.
We are the founders of Proyecto Más Color.
We kind of sound alike.
We were both born in Oklahoma.
We grew up in both Oklahoma and Katy, Texas, and our parents are from Honduras.
We started off around maybe 2012 with the idea of Proyecto Más Color because growing up, we were watching Telemundo and Univision and these novelas with our mom, And we come from a Latin American household, and we speak Spanish in the house, but we found it odd that we never saw anyone that looked like us on Latin American television. When we were at school, like in grade school, it would be difficult to try to explain to either the Latinos or the African Americans what we were, because they were confused by our race, and they thought that being Latino or Hispanic was a race. So when they saw us and saw that we have a darker complexion, that we're Black, it was confusing to them. So we decided to come out with a YouTube video in order to explain exactly what an Afro-Latino is.
You know, a lot of people, I mean, people have not protested the fact that the novelas have European-looking characters. You know, that says a lot about the Hispanic people. It says that they're accepting this. And I think they're internalizing this idea that white is better, European features are better, and anything darker is just shoved to the side and shoved under the rug. It's a reflection of what they think, and it's a cause of what they think. It's a vicious cycle.
If someone asked me where I was from, then I would let them know that I'm Honduran and my family is from Honduras. And usually they say, oh, well, where is that? And I'll let them know where it is. And then the following question is, oh, so you speak Spanish? I'm like, yeah. Well, say something in Spanish. I'm like, why? When if I had the skin tone of like Jennifer Lopez, I don't think you would ask me that question. I think because of the fact that I'm Black, you're asking me to prove myself. I just found it kind of ignorant to ask that type of question when I just told you what I was and you just wanted proof for it. Our parents are Spanish teachers, and our mother has had experiences where parents will try to get their children out of her classroom because they wanted a native speaker to teach their children, which she is a native speaker, but because of the lack of education of others, they just assumed that she was an African American that learned Spanish.
Like, there are some people that get it. They know. But then there are a lot of people that are just willfully ignorant about it. Either they're willfully ignorant or they're just ignorant. You know, they don't know. They have no idea. Like, a lot of Mexicans don't know that there are Black people in Mexico. And or they do know, but they kind of just, you know, they're ashamed of it. The media is the window to the world for a lot of people. You know, a lot of people don't learn about other cultures. They don't travel. They don't see other things. So the media is very powerful. And I think that Univision and Telemundo, they're aware of their power to influence people and influence the way that they see the world. It's their responsibility to show diversity in the Latino community. It's their responsibility to show that Afro-Latinos can be more than just maids and gunmen. It's their responsibility to show that we are a unified culture. Like, we don't need to separate ourselves from the white Latinos and the indigenous Latinos and the Black Latinos. Like, Latinos are all one, you know? We need to portray that in the media.
That was Janelle Martinez, Anthony Otero, and Victoria and Sofia Arzu. Janelle Martinez is the founder of AintILatina.com. Anthony Otero is the author of the novel Hanging Upside Down. And Victoria and Sofia Arzu are the co-founders of Proyecto Más Color. For more information about our guests, go to our website, latinousa.org. Coming up on Latino USA.
Vinila Babungi Lidasun Dam, Lidasun Wataruma Wanigi.
The Afro-Honduran community of the Garifuna people. Stay with us, no se vayan.
Ooh. presencia sobrenatural, espectacular, eres number one. Ella es mi mamá, ella es mi abuela, ella es mi tía, eres number one. Africana, 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 eres number one.
And now, before we get back to the show, I want to read you this letter. It's from a first-time donor whose name is Helena. It says, "Thank you for helping me hear stories about myself, my family, and my friends, which have been previously lacking in the media. Your show highlights the beauty of our collective and individual cultures. I keep coming back for more. With each episode, I learn so much, nodding as if in deep conversation with a friend, and I often find myself laughing out loud, alone in my car, or needing to wipe my makeup before work due to crying from an emotional episode. Keep doing what you're doing for the Latino voice and for spreading honesty, beauty, and struggles of our people. Besos." So thank you, Helena. That was beautiful. You know, what we love is that we're telling stories about all Americans, and yet we feel so tied to some of the stories and issues that we cover. So I hope you'll join Helena. Maybe you'll write us a note and go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button. It's actually like it's going to make you feel really good because you'll know that you helped to contribute to our independent media, which, you know, we really need in our country right now. One last thing before we go back to the show. If you are listening to our show before March 10th, we are hosting two free live events in California, one on March 7th in Berkeley and one on March 9th in Sacramento. Go to our Latino USA Facebook page and click the links to our events for more details. And I would love to see you there in California. Nos vemos allí and gracias.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, whose National Hispanic Advisory Council is devoted to educating the Hispanic community about the causes, treatment, and prevention of cancer. Learn more at cancercenter.com. And from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, an online resource dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students with information and strategies about what works in K-12 education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. As we've reported here on Latino USA, there's been a major wave of migration to the United States from Central America, especially Honduras, over the last few years. What you might not have heard is that many of those migrants are Afro-Hondurans. They're part of a community known as the Garifuna. This is the Garifuna language, being spoken by 25-year-old migrant Sharon Guiti. The Garifuna are of mixed African and indigenous heritage. Their language has bits of English, French, and Spanish, blended in with Arawak, the language of the native peoples who once inhabited the Caribbean. Sharon is saying a prayer in Garifuna. We're in a church attending a special Martin Luther King Day service in the South Bronx, New York City. The organist strikes up, "We Shall Overcome," in Spanish, of course. The Bronx is home to the largest Garifuna community outside of Honduras. Between 2014 and 2015, hundreds of migrant Garifuna women with young children in tow turned up here seeking refuge with family members.
Estábamos en peligro.
Sharon is one of them. She, along with her 5-year-old daughter, rode on top of freight trains through Mexico to the U.S. border, where they were detained. When she was released, to her surprise, they clamped a GPS ankle monitor to her leg. The monitor hurt. It cut off circulation in her leg. And she says it was humiliating.
What did the ankle bracelet signify for you as a migrant, as a Garifuna?
Es una esclavitud moderna.
It's modern slavery, she says. In the old days, they put chains on our legs. Now, it's these electronics.
What does it feel like to be wearing this?
Mal. Emocionalmente, psicológicamente.
Bad, she says. Emotionally and psychologically. I came here fleeing violence and discrimination, looking for freedom.
I didn't think it was going to be like this. It's hard.
Es muy difícil para mí.
Did you think that this was a country that would offer you refuge?
Sí.
Yes, she answers. Most likely, she and the other women will be sent back to Honduras, where their lives might be in danger.
Pronunciamiento en favor de la paz.
But they're not leaving without a fight. In honor of Martin Luther King Day, the women and other Garifuna activists have called a press conference at the church to criticize the way they've been treated by immigration officials and to call for asylum. Altogether, thousands of Garifuna have left their towns and villages since 2014 and taken the dangerous journey across Central America and Mexico to get to the United States. Our producer Marlon Bishop visited Honduras and spent a week traveling through Garifuna towns to find out why an entire people are packing up and leaving their ancestral lands. Marlon picks up our story there.
All right, here's a challenge. Try not to be jealous of Luis Garcia. When he wakes up in the morning and he doesn't feel like working, he just grabs his hammock, ties it up between two palm trees, and goes back to sleep. Over there in the U.S., he says, if you go back to sleep, you're not going to eat that day. Now, it's not like food in Honduras is free or anything, but there is an ocean full of fish right there. So if you're hungry, you just grab your net and catch your lunch. Luis considers this for a second, laughs, and says, there's no way I'm leaving my country.
Yo no me voy de mi país.
When Luis does feel like working, he comes here to his workshop, where he makes Garifuna drums. Right now, he's giving his latest creation a little test drive. Luis's family has made drums for generations. He learned from his father. His infant daughter, still in diapers and braids, is already developing a knack for playing them. There's just four workshops like this one in the whole country. When Luis was a kid, there were eight people who made drums in his town alone. Why? One answer is emigration. Luis says, imagine you have four young people who would have learned to make drums, and they leave Honduras. Well, that's four less drum makers. Emigration is on the tip of Enrique's tongue because it's all anybody has been talking about recently. It started in the spring of 2014. There's been migration to the U.S. from Garifuna towns for a long time, a steady trickle of people. A lot of Garifuna were employed in the merchant marine, and they would desert when docked in places like New York. Today, in fact, most Garifuna people in Honduras have family in the States. But suddenly, in 2014, the trickle became a flood. People began leaving en masse. You probably heard about the so-called child migrant crisis that hit headlines in the summer of 2014. Well, many of those migrants were Garifuna, others with small children and teenagers on their own. Hundreds from each town left, thousands altogether, just up and gone. Now, the people left behind are saying their towns are feeling eerily quiet. To Garifuna leaders, the migration is worrying, a threat to the social fabric that's kept the Garifuna culture strong for centuries. Some are calling it an exodus. Jillian David's 14-year-old sister migrated during the height of the wave.
Me enteré porque dejé una nota en mi cama.
One afternoon, Jillian found a note on the bed from her sister. It said, if you're reading this, it's because I've left. Now, most of the recent coverage of migration in Honduras has focused on the terrible levels of gang violence in the cities. But Garifuna communities are mostly gang-free and safe by Honduran standards. So why are the Garifuna leaving?
En este momento yo pienso que la gente lo hizo por moda, porque estaba de moda.
She left because it's the fashion right now, Jillian says. They see videos on Facebook of their friends riding on freight trains off to some better, more exciting life. So they say, cool, let's go too. Jillian admits that she, too, thinks about leaving. And it's for a very real reason, which is that it's almost impossible for somebody like her to find a job in Honduras.
Por ser mujer es un problema, y una mujer garífuna todavía es un problema doble.
Being a woman is a problem, she says. Being a Garifuna woman is a double problem. For example, if you go to the city and apply for a job at a department store, they'll tell you that the job has been filled and then give the job to somebody else who isn't black. But many in the community will tell you that the emigration isn't only about economic hardship. Deep down, it's about land.
El pueblo garífuna enfrenta un tercer destierro.
This is Miriam Miranda. She's a leader of a grassroots garífuna political movement called Ofrané. She says the garífuna's ancestral lands are under threat. Every day, there's less space for us to go, she says.
Cada día hay menos espacio donde podamos irnos.
But before we can talk about the land, we need to take a little detour to talk about the history. So, the garífuna people originally are not from Honduras. They come from the island of St. Vincent. You see, back during the colonial land grab, both the English and the French claimed St. Vincent as their own. They couldn't resolve who owned the island, so they decided to leave it as a neutral island, a place where the indigenous Arawak could live in peace. There's a few different accounts of how Africans first got to St. Vincent. But according to one of the most popular, a pair of slave ships shipwrecked on the island. The Africans who were on board mixed with the Arawak, adopting many aspects of their culture. They became the garífuna. Later on, the British were like, actually, we do want this island. Well, they were awarded St. Vincent in a treaty. And soon after, they invaded. The garífuna fought them off bravely for years, but eventually were defeated in 1796. The British went on to exile the entire garífuna population to what is today Honduras. Over the years, the garífuna spread out and settled all along the beaches of Central America, from Belize and Guatemala all the way down to Nicaragua. No matter what country they live in, the garífuna share a common culture. A language, a seafood-rich cuisine, religious traditions, and, of course, music. This is the great Rolando Sosa, a.k.a. Chichi Man, playing guitar in his back patio in Sambo Creek. The kind of music he's playing is called parranda, sometimes referred to as the garífuna blues. In any case, the garífuna lands in Central America that were once wide open for the taking are now hotly contested, and you could see why.
What does it look like? Well, Barra Vieja is like a paradise.
That's Raymond Grant, and he's not exaggerating even a little bit.
Nothing but natural beauty. You know what I'm saying? The trees, you know what I'm saying? The forest, the sea, the lagoon.
If there's a heaven, I really hope it looks like Barra Vieja. It's a small village of a few dozen families who live on this spit of land between a lagoon and the Caribbean Sea. There are these dramatic mountains in the distance. Flocks of pelicans just casually float by. Most afternoons, the town's residents hang out in the shade of a large tree, playing dominoes and listening to a soccer game on the radio. When I visit, a group of men are building a house. Carlos Castillo, head of the town council, says there's a system they use here called mano vuelta. Basically, it means you help me build my house and I'll help you build yours. And it's not like you have to buy a plot of land before you build. You just ask politely. But the Honduran government plays by a different set of rules. Carlos says that in September 2014, the Honduran police paid the town a visit. They pulled out a piece of paper that said, the land you live on belongs to the National Ports Company, and you guys have to leave. Now. They went into the homes and threw people's belongings outside. They warned the residents that they'd be back. The residents have stood their ground so far and haven't been bothered since, but the mood is tense.
This land right here is an ancestral heritage.
To Raymond Grant, the idea that the port company owns the land he was born and raised on is absurd.
We've been living here for years after years, you know what I'm saying? For centuries. And they want to take all these lands and build big buildings, you know what I'm saying, only for rich people. We ain't got no other place to live. Where else are we going to go?
Nobody knows exactly why the ports company is trying to evict them, but they can be reasonably sure that it has something to do with the town's next-door neighbor.
Indura Beach and Golf Resort.
The Indura Beach and Golf Resort. It opened in 2014, the crown jewel of Honduras's plan to make the country a world-class tourist destination. Indura, the name of the resort, means Honduras in the garífuna language. And all the press materials for the hotel are covered with images of garífuna people smiling and dancing. But locals haven't been smiling about this hotel for a long time. Garífuna communities have been fighting development here since the mid-90s, when the government first encroached on traditional lands, with the dream of turning the area into a Central American Cancun. International lawsuits and unexplained murders of community leaders followed. In the end, the hotel went up, and nearby garífuna communities were given a 7% ownership stake. The National Port Company did not respond to my request for comment about the eviction at Barravieja, but I did speak with the director of the Honduran Institute of Tourism, Emilio Silvestri.
My name is Emilio Silvestri.
He says that the Garifuna have been treated extremely well throughout the development of the resort.
All of those areas where the Garifunas have lived is respected, every inch, because one of our treasures of our country, of Honduras, is our cultures.
The minister claimed not to have any information about what happened at Barravieja, although he did suggest that some Garifuna groups in the area are squatting on land that isn't theirs. He says they're claiming this land as their own in order to sell later. Barravieja residents, however, say that these are blatant lies.
They're lying! There is one, I've never been there!
Regardless, the drama at Barravieja is just one example of pressure on Garifuna lands. Miriam Miranda, the activist leader we heard from before, ticks off those pressures. Tourism, agribusiness, drug trafficking. For Miriam, it all comes down to this, that the government, no matter how much it insists otherwise, doesn't recognize the Garifuna's right to their ancestral lands. Because if the government recognized that right, they'd protect it, she says. When you add it all up, the lack of respect for Garifuna land, the lack of investment in things like schools and roads in Garifuna communities, the institutionalized racism, it all adds up to a message to young Garifuna men and women that Honduras doesn't care about you or your future. And when you consider that, migrating makes all the sense in the world. But Garifuna activists are fighting back. They want to create a Honduras that young Garifuna will want to stay in, where they'll see a future for themselves. To see how, I visit a place called Vallecito. You could call it ground zero for the Garifuna resistance. It's a chunk of ancestral land in a remote part of Honduras that the Garifuna activists have managed to win title to in a Honduran court. It's not much to look at, a big clearing in the forest with a few simple homes. Only a handful of people currently live here full-time. But Miriam Miranda has big plans for Vallecito, to transform it into a Garifuna sanctuary where anybody who has been displaced around the country can come and live instead of having to migrate. Shortly after we arrive, a yellow school bus rolls in with visitors for the weekend. About 50 Garifuna in their teens and 20s are here to support the project. They spend the day clearing land and planting it with crops like yuca and peppers. At night, they'll sleep outside in makeshift tents. For the young people that come here, it's almost like a Garifuna summer camp, time in nature, away from all the smartphones and Facebook accounts.
Vivir el tiempo que vivió mi bisabuela, ¿no?
Erlan Diego, a youth leader, says it's like living in the times of his great-grandmother.
Sin luz, sin tecnología.
Living without electricity, without technology, with a mindset of brotherhood. He says, I want to live like this the rest of my life.
Quiero vivir el resto de mi vida, ¿no?
In the middle of our conversation, two gunshots ring out. The shots are a reminder that this isn't summer camp. Not really. Before the Garifuna got here, this land was occupied by a drug lord who had a ranch here. In fact, he still operates an airstrip on the land for landing shipments of cocaine. And just over the property line, the powerful oligarch Miguel Facuse has a palm plantation. Neither of them want the Garifuna here. Miriam and other leaders here have received various death threats. By nighttime, the gunshots are forgotten. Another, different type of sound fills the air. A group of kids are gathered around a fire, playing drums and dancing. This kind of scene is not common in Honduras at all these days. Most people are more interested in pop culture from the U.S. or Jamaica than traditional music, says Miriam.
Hay una nueva generación entonces que está perdiendo su identidad.
Miriam wants to see Vallecito become a place where cultural knowledge can grow instead of shrink.
La cultura es un arma de resistencia muy fuerte.
Culture can be a powerful weapon of resistance, she says. She means that the drums resounding through the countryside, they contain a message to all the people all around that would love to see the Garifuna gone. The message says we're here, and by coming together, we're not going to let you push us around. It's a message you can hear wherever the Garifuna are, from here in Vallecito to the beaches of Barravieja to the Bronx, where migrant mothers are seeking refuge. We are here.
Our producer Marlon Bishop reported that story in Honduras in association with Round Earth Media. Imer Gerardo Chévez of Radio Progreso co-reported our story. We first aired this piece at the beginning of 2015. And since then, there's been a big decrease in the number of Garifuna migrants leaving Honduras for the U.S. The reason, in part, is that the Garifuna people who came in 2014 haven't had much success with their asylum cases. They're living in crowded apartments or in homeless shelters. They can't work to support themselves. And there's a good chance they'll be sent back home with their young children. So word has gotten around that coming to the U.S. might not be the best solution to the problems that the Garifuna face. The decrease is certainly not because things have gotten better for the Garifuna in Honduras. Exclusion and discrimination are as bad as ever. And in the last year, there's been at least one assassination attempt on a Garifuna leader over issues regarding land. Coming up on Latino USA.
Yet you identify me as African-American U.S. And not that that's an issue for me, because I'm that as well. But what is it that you see when you see me?
We can't talk Afro-Latinos without hearing from la madrina of Afro-Latinos in the U.S., Marta Moreno-Vega. Stay with us. No se vayan. Let me take a minute to introduce you to NPR Music's other Discovery podcast. It's called Alt Latino. Hosts Felix Contreras and Jasmine Guards are your guides into the world of Latino music. Trust me, it's not a stodgy museum tour. There's alternative approaches to traditional music, interviews with icons like Calle 13 and Carlos Santana. So you can find Alt Latino now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Hace mucho tiempo, por dinero estoy sintiendo cosas que me están enloqueciendo. Sigo como el viento, esperando tu silencio. Mientras tu caricia yo recuerdo y no me digas no, corazón, que no quieres bailar esta canción. Seguramente se te olvidó que aquí lo que te gusta llegó. Y tu cadera pa' yo, siempre haremos de compás. No importa lo que pase, esta vez vas a gozar. Te juro que tus ojos me enloquecen de verdad. Te juro que tu cuerpo es donde quiero caminar.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Walton Family Foundation, working to prepare all students for a lifetime of opportunity by ensuring access to high-quality K-12 choices. More information is available at waltonk12.org. And the Candida Fund, dedicated to advancing the dignity of individuals and the sustainability of communities across the U.S. and around the globe through investments in transformative leaders and ideas. Learn more at CandidaFund.org.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we're talking about the Afro-Latino community. And there's one friend of Latino USA who we just had to bring back. Dr. Marta Moreno-Vega has, for decades now, been a leader in the Afro-Latino community in the U.S. and worldwide. In 1976, she founded the Caribbean Cultural Center, African Diaspora Institute in New York City. Marta's institute raises awareness of the way African legacies and histories weave into Latino and other Pan-American identities. And she came to our studios to talk about it. Starting with a musician she feels is at the heart of Afro-Latino jazz.
Mario Bauza came from Cuba, understanding the nexus between Afro-Cuban music and U.S. African-American jazz. So I would say that he understood the concept of rhythm in its global sense.
We'll be right back.
The reality for African descendants throughout the globe is that there was a dispersal over 500 years of more than anywhere from 15 million to 200 million Africans were dispersed throughout what we know as the Americas today. The spread has been phenomenal in terms of its influence. I think there is a better awareness now of the presence of African influence in Latino cultures, but the inherent racism and discriminatory practices still persist in a very basic and fundamental way within families as well as in the broader culture, so that it's an issue that's still challenging for Latinos who are of African descent. I can get into a cab and a Latino taxi driver who doesn't speak any English will start speaking to me in English. He's darker than I am or she's darker than I am, and then they'll talk to me in English. And then when I speak in Spanish, it's like, oh, you speak Spanish. Even the self-awareness, because I ask myself, well, what do you see when you look in the mirror? You're darker than I am, yet you identify me as African-American U.S. And not that that's an issue for me, because I'm that as well, but what is it that you see when you see me? And what is it that you see when you see you in the mirror? You know what I'm saying? So equity means access to resources, access to information, and also the ability to reach decision makers and policy makers that influence the cultural life, the educational life, the job reality of our communities, the health of our communities, housing. How is that equitable that rents are so that most people who are working families can't afford to live in their communities? What one does is provide information that's not available elsewhere. And I think that that's what the Caribbean Cultural Center has done, not only to our young from our families, but to the broader community, because I think people are at a deficit when they don't have information. So that all of us are miseducated to a degree. It influences how we dress, how we think, how we eat. And it also influences the broader community and the broader world. I mean, when hip-hop started, you didn't see hip-hop in commercials. Now you see, you know, Cheerios, you know, a bumblebee dancing to hip-hop. I mean, how ridiculous is that? You know, when hip-hop started in the South Bronx, right, with Latino, you know, Caribbean and African-American youth. And you see the evolution and influence of our communities, yet our people are not valued. The issue of immigration is central. I mean, this country was founded on immigration. I mean, the only people that belong on Turtle Island, which is Manhattan, are the native peoples. We're on their land. So that immigration has always been an issue. The difference is that for European immigrants, they're treated differently. A white Caucasian immigrants are treated differently than those who come from Latin America, the Caribbean, Central America. So the darker you are, the more inequitable your presence is and more discriminatory and racist it is in terms of how you have to overcome challenges. And for, let's say, the Garifuna community that's coming, you're coming to a land that you understand is free and understand it's democratic, that understands that the Statue of Liberty has her hands open to you. And when you're here, you see that her back is to you. Not only is it a shock, it's devastating, because you come to a country that says it's democratic, yet there's a big question mark about that democracy for who.
That was Dr. Marta Moreno Vega, founder of the Caribbean Cultural Center, African Diaspora Institute. So Latin America isn't the only place where people of African descent speak Spanish.
Spain actually had one colony in sub-Saharan Africa as well, what is today the tiny country of Equatorial Guinea, sandwiched between Cameroon and Gabon. Many Equato-Guinean immigrants and their descendants live in Spain now. The most renowned of them is the singer and poet known as Buica.
Hush now, don't explain, to say you're remaining younger, you're back home.
Buica's music draws on Spanish copla and flamenco, Latin American and African music, soul, jazz, and the blues. She's recorded 9 albums, won all sorts of awards, and has even written a book of poetry. It's titled A los que amaron a mujeres difíciles y acabaron por soltarse, which translates as To Those Who Loved Difficult Women and Ended Up Leaving Them. Buica joins us today from the studios of WLRN in Miami. And welcome to Latino USA, Buica. We're so happy to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you to have me here. Thank you.
So, Buica, I want you to talk a little bit about the experience of growing up in Mallorca, which is an island that is part of Spain. It's in the Mediterranean. But you're the child of African refugees from Equatorial Guinea. So what was that like, mamita?
When I was a little girl, I used to hear so many stupidity around me. When I was going home, they used to tell me, you are not pure African. When I was going in the street, they used to tell me, you are not from Spain. So at the end, you don't know where you are from or where you belong to, you know.
Did you grow up in pain? Were you sad? Were you confused? Did it make you angry?
Well, mamita, if you want me to be honest, I never felt none of those things because I have a happy mama.
But your mom was a refugee, right? So she had to leave her mm-hmm. country. So where did that joy come from in your mom, as you understand it?
She always lives one day at a time, just one day at a time. We were 6 brothers and sisters plus a couple of cousins, and she was alone because Papa wasn't there, and she was cleaning in the hotels, and you know. Obviously, that is too many kids for just one salary. I didn't see my mom cry, not even once in my life. She always had a minute in the day to dance and laugh and talk to us about God. I don't know. She's magic. I don't know.
You started, and I love this, you started as a singer by inventing songs that were the blues, and you were singing, right? And you were singing in something that you said was English, and nobody really knew what you were singing, but it kind of sounded, I guess, American. But what do you think about this connection, this deep connection that you had to Black American culture through the blues, and here you are, this child growing up in Mallorca?
Well, I think that we share the same feelings, and it's not about Boston or Mallorca or China. I think that is a common feeling that we share a lot of people in the world, you know. There's a communication beyond words in the music. We're crying for the same feelings. We keep on hiding to each other the same secrets, but still being the same secrets, you know?
Yeah.
Se me hizo fácil borrar de mi memoria a esa mujer.
That's a little bit of the song Se Me Hizo Fácil, which is from your 2009 album El Último Trago, The Last Drink, with Cuban pianist Chucho Valdez. Now, you could almost call that, amita, like an Afro-Latino blues song. What was it like to work with Chucho Valdez?
He makes you feel that you know things that you don't know. That is incredible. Sometimes I remember when last time I played with him, I was flying like a bird. Yeah.
But Buica, your artistry really isn't just limited to singing or performing. You know, you wrote a book of poetry in 2014 that is really a very intimate expression of yourself. So it's not just your poems, it's your photography, and it's a lot of photographs of you naked.
No, I'm not naked. I'm just undressed. It's not the same. All the people that read that book, I want them to remind the artist the way it really was. I don't want them to remind costumes. I don't like to use filters. I'm the way I am. And I think it's kind of cool. I feel that I'm cool. I don't know why.
Oh, you are definitely cool, mija, let me tell you. We got, you know, one of the things that's fascinating, of course, you and I have never met until today. And some people who are hearing this interview might just say, why do they keep on calling each other mama?
Because all women in the world are twinned up by tears. We are sisters by our tears, yeah? I think so.
Sometimes the ones that we don't show and sometimes the one that we do show.
Right. Amen.
I want to end by reading a little bit of a poem that you wrote from your book. The poem is titled Cúrate África, which basically is cure yourself, Africa. And this is what you wrote. It says, Cúrate África nuestra o de nadie. Cúrate porque no vas a morir aunque lo intentas, aunque reniegues, aunque lo parezca, y por mucho que te duela, tú ya no morirás. Which,
right,
roughly translated is, Africa, you're not going anywhere. Take care of yourself. Heal yourself. What's your message?
It's not about to be a victim anymore. No time for the hope. Hope is for the people who can sit down and wait. You know? Action is the word. I wrote down this poem because I'm just, you see the images on TV of Africa dying per years. I remember when I was 7 years old that I saw those Ethiopian images of skinny, skinny, skinny kids dying every day of hunger. Things didn't change at all. I'm 42. Stop being a victim, you know. Africa have to cure itself. She have to work for herself and she have to grow and cure herself because she can do it. It's not that she cannot do it. She can do it, you know. It's just my idea.
And for that idea and so many other ideas, Mamita, my fellow woman sister who I've never met, thank you so much, Buika, for all of your
work. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you.
Un placer.
Un placer.
Buika's book of poetry, A los que amaron a mujeres difíciles y acabaron por soltarse, is available at select bookstores and online. And her most recent album is titled Vivir Sin Miedo, which means live without fear. She joined us from the studios of WLRN in Miami. And as we wrap up today's Afro-Latino episode, we're going to hear again from Janelle Martinez. Remember her from the top of the show? She's the founder of AintILatina.com, a website focused on Afro-Latino identity. And for today's sabiduría, or words of wisdom, Janelle is going to read us an adaptation of an essay previously published on her site. It's called Outsider Within. Here's Janelle Martinez.
For most of my life, I never quite felt like I fit in when it came to my racial identity. It's taken 26 years to feel okay with that. In fact, I now celebrate the unique characteristics and extraordinary things that make up my cultural background. I've always known that I was Latina. My family spoke Spanish and Garífuna, and my skin is several shades above tan. A recent trip to San Jose, Costa Rica, allowed me to revisit my outsider within perspective. It's one I thought I'd resolved fully, but quickly learned wasn't once I landed. I gifted myself a trip to La República de Costa Rica for my 26th birthday. But shortly after landing, the outsider within thoughts began creeping in. Your Spanish isn't that good, chica. You're morena, so prepare yourself. The thought left me hesitant to speak Spanish. I was there for roughly 4 days and halfway through the trip said, I'm closer to my roots than I've been all year. I'm gonna live in the moment. It's not until I let go that I really got to connect with the experience and my people. I was even asked if I was from Limón, where many of the Black people in Costa Rica reside. Needless to say, I'll be returning to Costa Rica to explore Limón. There's a Limón in Honduras, too, and I want to see the similarities between both places. As Latinos, we come in all shades and toting all kinds of experiences. With that being said, we should never feel isolated by anyone, let alone one another. It's taken many years and growth to get to this place. But I receive emails and have conversations with Latinos who struggle with the intersection of Black and Latino identity. meaning more self-education needs to happen. As an adult, the onus is on you.
That's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our intern is Laura Calzada. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks this week to Kevin Rinker at WABE in Atlanta and to Round Earth Media for funding our reporting trip to Honduras. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And Carnegie Corporation, promoting the advancement of knowledge and understanding.
At that time, I was like, why is she playing that horrible music for old people?
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl. With flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide, learn more at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with others to build a culture of health, enabling all in America's diverse society to lead healthier lives, now and for generations to come. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA.
The way they did it was literally slit the throats with butcher knives of the wealthiest Mexican Americans in the county, and then leaving their bodies hanging from trees all along the county.
From extrajudicial killings to mob violence and segregation, the hidden history you may not have read about in your textbooks. That's next time on Latino USA.